dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the War of Ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. The war for the free world, of course, requires the incredible courage and often sacrifice of freedom fighters to wage that war. We are very privileged to have with us one of my favorite freedom fighters. Her name is Elizabeth Sabatish Wolf. She's been on our program before, but we are catching up with her on the eve of the publication of a very important new book that she has written entitled The Truth is No Defense. It features, in addition to her own story and narrative, expert analyses of a number of others of the case that we'll be discussing with her today. Let me just say, Elizabeth, it is so good to have you with us. I want to draw on your experiences in Austria, but really what we've learned from them here in America as well. And it's a delight to have you back. And again, congratulations on the new book.
Well, thank you so much, Frank. And it's always wonderful to be on your show. I consider it a privilege to be on your show and to explain what's going on in Austria and in Europe right now.
Thank you. Well, this is the point of the exercise, so let's get to it. Elizabeth, you, of course, teach English now in Austria, but you've had a lot of experiences growing up and as a young adult in the Muslim world, and it has informed your understanding of, well, the nature of Sharia, most especially, but also its practice as a sort of brutally repressive totalitarian doctrine. And I'm very interested in talking with you about that first, and then we'll talk about its implications for the rest of us. But just give us a quick sort of reminder of your personal exposure to and involvement with those who practice and seek to impose on the rest of us this doctrine of Sharia.
Well, as I explain in my book, as I like to call myself, I'm a diplomat's brat. I grew up in many different countries thanks to my father's job in the Austrian Ministry of Foreign Affairs. And because of that, because of the traveling around the world, I was, let's say, privileged to grow up in or spend part of my childhood in countries like Iran, in countries like Iraq. But also, and this is the reason why my English is so good, I grew up in both New York and Chicago, where I attended school, and also learned about the U.S. Constitution and its beauty and the Bill of Rights, and that, you know, freedom is not something to be taken for granted.
Freedom is not free, as we say here. Yeah.
It's definitely not free. And again, because I grew up in Iran and experienced the shift from a fairly free country under the Shah to a brutal dictatorship of Ayatollah Khomeini with the imposition of Sharia law, the strict imposition of Sharia law. That is where my journey began. And as I detail in the book, it was inevitable that I would turn into the critic of Islam and Islamic doctrine that I turned into. I mean, there was basically no way out for me, especially because of Iran and all the freedom that I experienced and in the United States. And of course, my love for the United States Constitution.
And this love has been expressed over the years in your many speeches in this country, your writings over there, and it's very evident in your book as well. And we're going to talk in a moment about, you know, the degree to which Sharia, this Islamic political, military, legal doctrine, is at odds with that constitution. But before we do, I want to get just the flavor of how you found this doctrine in practice in Iran, oppressing you personally as well as the people of that country.
It didn't, honestly, I have to tell you, it didn't oppress me yet in Iran, because I was a 6 and 7 year old. And what I just witnessed, in essence, what I witnessed was that women did not cover their hair before the Ayatollah Khomeini imposed Sharia law. What I witnessed was that all of a sudden people were angry. There was no freedom. People were oppressed. People, the oppression. I listened to my parents talking about how this friend of ours and that friend of ours all of a sudden found themselves in jail, not to be seen again. We couldn't walk in the streets anymore because of the so-called Pasdaran revolutionary guards. It is always a feeling of freedom, not to be able to do what you want to do. I have to tell you that the true oppression of Sharia law only became apparent to me when I was much older and when I was living in Kuwait and Libya in the late 1990s and the first year of 2000. When I was older and I understood and I could look more into society. I describe in the book, for instance, how I was doing a long distance degree and I had to write a paper, and I chose the topic of women's rights because at the time there was talk in Kuwait about granting women the right to vote. And that was back in 1998 or 1999, I think. And I did a lot of interviews with women from all walks of life, from Bedouin women to normal housewives, Kuwaiti housewives, and also business women, managers. And let me tell you, and this has made a very, very big impression on me, all of these women, every single one of them, in one way or another, said to me, "Why do we need the right to vote? Our husbands vote for us anyway." And that really epitomizes the lack of freedom that these women enjoy in our sense of freedom. You see, they don't feel oppressed. We think they are oppressed. They don't believe they need the right to vote. And I think we ought to respect that without giving up our rights, our freedoms. That's what I learned living in Kuwait, that, you know, they should be free to wear their headscarves. I have absolutely no problem with that. But they should not demand to be wearing headscarves in our countries.
Yeah, that's the point on which I want to pick up. Elizabeth Sabadish-Wolf is our guest. We'll talk with her right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom. With Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We are speaking with Elizabeth Sabadish-Wolf, a veteran of the long, hard struggle for freedom in, of all places, her native Austria and in Europe more broadly. We're going to talk now, having set the stage, Elizabeth, very nicely with your last comment about the imposition of Sharia and its repressive qualities in the West, because it brings us right to your personal experiences in your native Austria and your efforts to, well, teach about, raise a warning concerning this tendency on the part of the adherents to Sharia. Talk a little bit about your experience with such warnings and what flowed from them.
When I was living in Kuwait in the late 1990s, I would always return to Austria once a year for an extended vacation. And during that time, I was on public transportation. I rode the underground, and I would see a gradual change in the population. I would see more women wearing headscarves. I would see people from the Balkan states, Balkan countries, who were granted refugee status in Austria because of the Bosnian War. And that's where I first noticed how Austria was noticeably changing. And then I returned from Libya in 2001, and the change became even more apparent. The only way you could really notice it is the women in headscarves. There were more and more and more. And because I didn't read a book concerning Sharia law or the history of Islam, or I didn't read the Quran until about 2007. And that's when I really started to get worried, to think, how are we going to stop our population from changing? How are we going to be able to reverse this? How are we going to deal with society that is just, the speed was just unbelievable. So the first thing I did, I educated myself. Everything that I experienced was now backed up by Islamic law, by Islamic doctrine, by, like I said, the Quran and the Hadith, the sayings of Muhammad. And that's how I began. And then I said to myself, I have to do something. You can't just be afraid. You also have to do something constructive, of course, without any use of violence, because I don't want violence in any way, shape, or form. I just don't like it. So I then offered a political part. Actually, I offered it to all political parties, but of course, only the Austrian Freedom Party agreed to host me with a 12-hour seminar on a fully sourced seminar on Islam and its implications on Western civilization, especially European society. And these seminars drew a lot of interest because, everyday people would experience what this change in society did to them. They knew, they could feel it, they could see it, and they wanted to know the reason. I gave them the reason. Again, it was fully sourced. And in exactly almost to the day, 10 years ago, my seminar was infiltrated by a left-wing journalist who surreptitiously recorded the seminar and then sent the evidence, the tapes, to the prosecutor. And the prosecutor decided to press charges first for hate speech. And this charge was later, during the court proceedings, changed from hate speech to denigration of religious teachings of a legally recognized religion in Austria.
Let me just ask you, what specifically was it that you said that precipitated in the first instance this charge of hate speech and then denigrating a religion, in this case, Islam?
Well, at first it was everything I said. Every single thing in those 12 hours was a problem for the prosecutor. For instance, I called out in the seminars. I said, we must say yes to democracy and no to theocracy and theocratic rule. The prosecutor didn't like me saying that. That's just how crazy the whole proceedings were. And during the court proceedings, I was grilled on many different aspects of Islamic law and it became very, very clear after playing the tapes that there was absolutely no hate speech and no incitement to hatred. And then the judge, at her own discretion during the proceedings, said, well, I want to make you aware that I'm adding another charge for a sentence that you said. And that is denigration of religious teaching. So the sentence, you might wonder, that I uttered was during the course of a discussion during the seminar, which concerned the Prophet Muhammad's behavior with a six-year-old girl and whom he later married and consummated the marriage when she was 9 years old. And I asked the rhetorical question, and forgive me if I don't fill in the blank, because I am in Austria right now and I don't enjoy the protections of the First Amendment. I asked the rhetorical question, what do we call this behavior if not, and you fill in the blank, please, Frank.
Pedophilia.
Exactly. Thank you. I don't want to say it because I'm in Austria and I don't want to get in trouble again.
But let's just tease this out. You got in trouble for talking about something that is a fact in the sacred texts of Islam itself. You were describing it, and what did the prosecutor and then the judge find in the course of this proceeding with regard to it?
The prosecutor was silent during the entire proceeding. It was the judge who said, and later on also the appeals court, that said, it is a known fact that Muhammad married a six-year-old and consummated the marriage when she was nine, but you cannot call it what you did because that is an excess of opinion.
An excess of opinion. And it offended religious feelings? Is that where this idea came up?
No, that came later. The religious feelings, the offense of religious feelings came a year ago when I was when the verdict was upheld by the European Court of Human Rights. At first, it was just an excess of opinion, but later on, the European Court of Human Rights ruled that my right to freedom of speech is worth less than the right not to be offended, you know, the right of a certain group not to be offended.
Well, and this is really what I want to get at with you, Elizabeth Sabatish-Wolf, and we're nearing the end of our time together. But I just wanted to say, you were tried in a country that is regarded as part of the free world for speech that was factually based. And I believe it was in the course of this trial that the title of your book was first uttered. Is that right?
Correct. Exactly. The truth is, you know, I said the truth and nothing but the truth during all of my trials, nothing but the truth. There was nothing for me to take back without losing, you know, sight of myself, basically lying. And in this case, and there's many others, many cases that will follow and are already in progress, the truth is no longer a defense. And once we get this far, once we reach the point where the truth is no longer defense, we're lost. There is no longer any semblance of freedom of speech, because we all know that we don't need we need freedom of speech for that which is abhorrent, that which is disgusting, that which you may not like, and there's no such thing as a right not to be offended. But the European Court of Human Rights has ruled that there is a right not to be offended, and my right to freedom of speech is worth less than others' rights not to be offended.
This is so chilling, Elizabeth, indeed. And the problem is that Europe has now become increasingly governed by these kinds of edicts and restrictions and Sharia blasphemy laws, effectively. Just, if you could quickly, tell us about the implications of what has happened in Europe for us here in the United States as well. I'm thinking in particular of the application of some of these laws to Google and Facebook and YouTube, for example. But are we facing the similar kind of restrictions here as you see it?
Well, you're already in the midst of it. I mean, I'm sure that you have seen the recent poll where 51% of millennials call for fines or jail time for hate speech. I mean, you're not far behind. This is I mean, unbelievable. Though to me, it's not surprising that you now have polls where Americans call for fines or jail time for hate speech. I mean, this is chilling. This is extremely dangerous. And what is happening in Europe is now in the United States. But the main difference when I'm asked is that you in the United States, you still have a chance to fight this, and especially to fight it in court.
Elizabeth Sabatish-Wolf, carry on, and I hope you will come back to us. Thank you so much for your exemplary efforts and the warning that you're sounding. God bless you. Next up, we'll speak with Gordon Chang, straight ahead.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back, joined as we have the privilege of being each week by one of the country's preeminent experts on matters involving Asia, and in particular, our interests there, and most especially, the threat posed to our interests and, well, indeed to us by the rising power in Asia, Communist China. His name, of course, is Gordon Chang. He is the author of three terrific books, The Coming Collapse of China, Nuclear Showdown, North Korea Takes on the World, and Losing South Korea. We'll be touching on each of these subjects in turn with Gordon. Gordon, it's always good to have you with us, but especially as it seems as though the changes that are taking place now in China are accelerating and the implications of those changes are becoming more and more important for all of us to understand. If I could, first of all, say welcome. It's good to have you back. And second, I want to get an update from you on trade, especially in light of a very important piece that you've written about it in Gatestone. Welcome.
Well, thank you so much, Frank. And right now, of course, the Trump administration is negotiating with China on what is called a phase one trade deal. There are hopes in the administration that they'll be able to sign something in the middle of next month, when President Trump meets his counterpart Xi Jinping at the APEC meeting in Chile. There are reports that this is going forward, that there are phone negotiations at a high level. We really don't know. We've heard this optimism before. And of course, in early May, the Chinese withdrew concessions across the board. We also know this time that although there's been an announcement of a deal, President Trump did that on October 11th in the Oval Office. Both sides have said that they want additional negotiations, additional meetings, which sounds like they have a lot more talking to do before they can actually document a deal. So right now, there are these reports, as I say, but we have just got to wait to see how all this wraps up.
And Gordon, when you say that they're interested in more detailed discussions and agreements, does that mean that this is likely to be less of a skinny deal or less of a deal altogether because of the nature of the Chinese negotiating strategy at this moment?
My sense, and this is just a guess, is that the phase one deal, if it actually ever is inked, will be a lot skinnier than the markets hope. There have been talk that there would be, for instance, market opening moves, as well as intellectual property protections in phase one. That's sort of hard to believe unless that the wording is very vague in general and really means nothing. My sense is just that, this is more sort of vaporware in a sense. But we've got two very willful figures, Trump and Xi Jinping. So almost anything can happen. But I do tend to think that if the past is any pattern for us and any indication of what will happen in the future, there's going to be difficulties ahead. There's a more fundamental issue, Frank, and that is that we should not be negotiating a trade deal with China that has never honored trade deals. So the remedy for all of the problems we've had with China in this area is not to ink another agreement. but is actually just to impose the cost until Beijing stops the intellectual property theft and Beijing starts complying with its prior trade deals. On top of that, I've got another wish list, and that is China just pays us back for all the intellectual property it's stolen. Now, that's trillions of dollars, but nonetheless, I think that's a fair request.
Well, your point in the Gatestone article is so important, and that is the trustworthiness of these folks. Even if they make a deal, they don't honor the terms. And even if they were to honor the terms, they're likely to be less than we think they will entail. So for all these reasons, whether, Gordon, it's upping the ante on our part, as you've suggested, or whether it's simply being much more realistic about the nature of these negotiating partners and what they have in mind for us, which is only partly, you know, raping us on trade, as they have been doing now for so long. It's really, you know, our domination more generally. And it's very hard to see how this can be made less of a problem by an agreement that winds up, well, propping them up. And speaking of which, I want to turn to another topic we've visited about in the past, Gordon, but as it happens today, as we speak, the board that oversees the federal government's retirement system, known as the Thrift Savings Plan, is supposed to be reviewing a very ill-advised decision this board made a couple of years ago to begin allowing, or in a way, compelling U.S. government employees and military personnel, past and present, to invest in Chinese companies, some of which are very problematic indeed. We had a sort of riposte on the part of Wall Street by Henry Fernandez, who's the CEO of the Morgan Stanley Capital International family of indexes. Gordon, what did Henry Fernandez say about this idea of investing in Chinese companies, including some that are doing material harm to the Chinese people and I think increasingly threatening ours?
Well, Fernandez said that a cutoff of portfolio flows from the United States to China would be devastating to global markets. And what he's looking at, and I can understand his point that global markets would be shocked by that. But on the other hand, we've got to remember that China, if we continue to enrich it, is going to work to end the free flow of capital, free markets, and free societies. So that would be devastating as well. What we've got here is a real problem, and that is that the financial markets want these portfolio flows to continue. They do not see China as a threat to the United States, and they're very happy to enrich it. This is a mindset which is just anathema to the United States, and we've got to stop this because history will look – if we allow this portfolio flows to and the U.S. government to invest in Chinese companies, history will look back and condemn us for helping a country which is threatening the United States, which is harming our diplomats, injuring our military personnel, and threatening people's war on us. This is just insanity, Frank. I can't think of another word. This is just insanity.
Yeah. And Gordon, just so people can calibrate a bit on this, I'm told that if you look at the total amount of money that is flowing from our capital markets, and by that, let's put a fine point on it, that means people probably like our audience, if not directly, individually, certainly through institutional investments that they're making, perhaps through their pension funds, for example. I'm told it's all told something on the order of $14 trillion. Now, whether that's off by a trillion here or there doesn't matter. The point is that it's an immense amount of money that is keeping afloat this Chinese communist system and enabling it to do increasingly hostile things towards us. And with all due respect to Mr. Fernandez, it seems to me that it's high time, as you have suggested, Gordon, that we disengage rather than perpetuate and intensify the perils that are associated with this kind of practice. What do you say?
Yes, I think that we should cut off all portfolio flows, regardless of what happens to the global markets, because the consequences are just too extreme. Also, I think that we should consider requiring the repatriation of all American investment in China's markets. There's a number of things that are going on here, Frank, which we talk about week to week. But the other one that we don't focus in on is that right now, this is just from a financial point of view, a bad idea, because you have a China whose currency is falling fast, whose economy is crumbling. You know, this is just the wrong time to invest in China. But, you know, you add on top of that the strategic factors that we have been talking about. This is just this is wrong on every single count. And although the global markets might not like it, this is a step that we have to take. You know, right now we've got China engaged in monstrous activities, just killing minority members based on their race and ethnicity and their religion. And this is financing the Third Reich. I mean, how are we going to explain this to our children, Frank? I just don't know.
Well, to make matters worse, and at the risk of drilling down unduly on this particular point, but I feel so strongly about it, and I think you're so right, Gordon. On top of everything else, we are allowing this practice to happen even though the Chinese companies in question do not disclose the kind of information that their American counterparts are required to provide, that, you know, allow a proper assessment of the material risks, reputational as well as financial, that can be associated with these companies. And the reason for this, which I find just mind-boggling, is that the Chinese refuse to provide audits of these companies on the grounds that it's a state secret. Well, Gordon Chang, on the face of it, that would seem to me to be a perfect reason not to permit these kinds of companies to be gaining access to our markets and our investors and putting them at risk. Let's be clear. If their pension funds go away because of this kind of craziness with Chinese companies that are not accountable, are not transparent, who will be held accountable?
Yeah. I mean, in addition to all the other objections to this, which are more strategic, more fundamental, you know, you highlight the fact that Chinese companies don't provide information to investors. And we have a history of pillaging of investors, both Chinese and foreign, by Chinese enterprises. And just one other footnote to this, and that is that investments could very well go into companies which are on the Commerce Department's entity list. This is a list of companies that the United that Americans cannot do business with without prior permission from the Commerce Department.
You can invest in them, but you can't do business with them. I mean, it's just insane. Gordon, we have to pause. I appreciate so much your time. Thank you for giving us a bit more of it. We'll be right back with Gordon Chang right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. We have with us Gordon Chang, who is generously giving us a second block in the interest of covering a few other issues that really warrant our close attention. Gordon, as always, I appreciate so much your visits, but especially because you cover not only China, but what China is doing elsewhere in its own region and far beyond. And I thought it'd be important for us to spend a few minutes talking about one of the most odious aspects of the Chinese totalitarian mistreatment, as you mentioned a moment ago, of its own minorities. What can you tell us about this practice of organ harvesting that we hear is part of the abuse of the Falun Gong and perhaps the Uyghurs and others in China, at the hands of the Chinese Communist Party?
Yeah, recently victims of organ harvesting have talked to the public, and there is a Fox News story on this. There have been allegations for all of this century that China has systematically harvested organs from Falun Gong practitioners and from minorities and from prisoners about to be executed. And these have been documented in a number of cases. And some of these allegations to appear to be true. There's a lot that's been going on in this area, but one thing that has been very clear in that China has been advertising guaranteed organs for people. And that is for people who know the organ transplant area, know that, that China has to be executing people on schedule in order to meet its commitments. The great Arthur Waldron has participated in a tribunal on this. There is just so much more evidence coming to the fore. And it, it just shows the monstrosity of the Chinese system. It is just beyond belief.
It's right? Unspeakable. Gordon, let me ask you to turn, if you would, to one of China's overseas activities that's possibly quite ominous as well. The Antarctic is a continent that has been explored for, you know, many, many years, of course, and has had various outposts established. The Chinese seem to be seriously pursuing the idea that they're going to exercise some kind of permanent presence, but also dominion there, too. Tell us about that, if you can.
Yeah. Antarctica has actually been a continent where there are scientific stations. There's been exploration, as you say, but no claims. Various countries, including China, are now laying claim to Antarctica. And there's a belief that a decade or two from now, there will be systematic exploitation of minerals. China's Antarctic ambitions have been growing recently. And this means that there's going to be competition across the continent. Australia, New Zealand, China, the United States, Russia will all be participants in a new struggle. And this is really unfortunate. And largely, I think the Chinese are driving this because they're forcing others to take more aggressive postures towards Antarctica as well as the Arctic, because we're seeing this at both ends of both poles.
Both poles. And one of the things that typically accompanies the Chinese presence in places is a lot of environmental predation. Do you expect that that will be a feature of any further activities of the Chinese there, Gordon Chang?
Frank, it has to be. And this, of course, is not just China, but the Chinese are going to be the main players here. And that is any exploitation of minerals is going to involve environmental degradation of the type we've not seen. Antarctica has been untouched. And that has really been a jewel, a crown jewel of the world. But, you know, that's going to end if the Chinese get their way. So the United States and others need to make it clear that we need to keep the status quo in Antarctica, a peaceful place where there can be scientific observation and exploration, but no more.
Speaking of the Chinese asserting themselves, Gordon Chang, one of the other places that they've been active, of course, as we've discussed most weeks, is in the South China Sea. There seems to have been something of a easing of the tensions with Vietnam recently that were engendered by the Chinese insinuating themselves into Vietnamese waters. Is that a stay of execution, Gordon, in terms of Chinese ambitions there, or is it what you might call a commutation of sentence?
Well, the Chinese, and we've seen this now, this decade, have intruded into Vietnamese waters. They put an oil rig there 3 or 4 years ago, and then they leave. And this really is has a number of purposes. One of them, of course, is to stake their claims. The others is to scare away foreign companies like Exxon, like Indian Petroleum companies that want to explore in Vietnam's exclusive economic zone. So we're seeing this replay. China has been relatively quiet in the South China Sea for quite some time now, but they will ramp up the pressure. And this is, again, really a fool's errand for them, because the Vietnamese are absolutely determined to defend their seas. And Vietnam is now drawing support from other countries, including the United States. So I think China's playing a losing game with regard to Vietnam, but nonetheless, they are continuing what I think is going to be really dangerous activities, especially if they ramp up the pressure, which they probably will do at some point. We got to remember that they have fortified those seven or eight features in the Spratlys, which is in the southern portion of the South China Sea. There is an attempt, all throughout that body of water to exert control.
Yeah, and that clearly is the aspiration of the Chinese Communist Party. Gordon, let me turn to South Korea. You have, of course, written an important new book on the subject, Losing South Korea. I think we talked last week about the essentially forced resignation of the justice minister under Moon Jae-in. His wife now, as I understand it, is being brought up on charges. What does this suggest is the nature of the corruption inside Moon's administration, but also the prospects for it ultimately being supplanted by a government that is not, well, among other things, so hostile towards us?
Yeah. Just a little background. Moon Jae-in, the president of South Korea, appointed Cho Kuk as justice minister. And that was about 3 weeks ago. That was about a month ago. Cho Kuk resigned because he has been dogged by allegations of corruption. And prosecutors indeed have been investigating him. And one of the things that he did and first things he did as justice minister was to impede the investigation into the various scandals that surround him. His wife, about 3 days ago, was arrested by prosecutors for her involvement in some of these scandals. And that is a good sign. It shows that the prosecutors are able to withstand intense political pressure. Part of it is because Moon Jae-in suffered a severe loss of popularity when he appointed Cho Kuk. His approval ratings are now in the low 40s, according to the highest polls. Some polls say that his approval rating is in the 30s. He's certainly upside down with his disapproval rating higher than his approval rating. And so Moon was forced by public outrage across most elements of society at this appointment. And things are moving in the right direction. But the most important point is that Moon's Democratic Party of Korea retains its unity, whereas the conservatives who oppose Moon are now divided, fighting among themselves. And that means that Moon should be able to retain his position in the National Assembly in the April 15th, 2020 elections. That's a critical time for South Korea. And Moon seems to be ahead because his forces, although smaller, do appear to be united.
Well, I pray, Gordon, that among other good influences that you exercise, it will be on the South Korean opposition to come together and join forces, both for the interests of the South Korean people, of course, but also for ours in that region, which are being severely, it seems to me, undermined by Moon and his policies towards both the North Koreans and the Japanese, of course. Gordon, we have to leave it at that for the moment, though. Thank you so much for your time today, your extended time today. Follow Gordon Chang at Gordon G. Chang on Twitter, as well as follow him here, of course, at Fox News and The Daily Beast and elsewhere. An invaluable resource for all of us, and we appreciate so much your time. Come back to us again next week. I hope the rest of you will do the same again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.